Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Grammarly. Change the way you write with Grammarly Go, offering personalized generative AI communication assistance. Grammarly Go helps you ideate, compose, rewrite, and reply thoughtfully. Go to grammarly.com/go.
Hi, I'm Nathan from Planet Earth.
Hey, this is Edmund from Montana.
I'm Kent from Denver.
The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like me.
If you'd like to support the show, like I did,
visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate.
Take it away, Jesse.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, it's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. Nathan Rabin is the head writer of the AV Club, the cultural criticism wing of The Onion. His new book, The Big Rewind, is the story of how he got to that esteemed position. He spent most of his childhood in poverty, and he followed a stint in the mental hospital with a few years in a group home for emotionally disturbed teenagers. During his darkest times, he writes, he clung to film, television, and music, and he frames his memoir with the stories and records that were his emotional touchstones. I spoke to Nathan Rabin in the offices of the AV Club in Chicago. Nathan Rabin, welcome to the Sound of Young America.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Nathan, you frame the stories in your book with pop culture allusions and criticisms. And one of the ones that I found the most interesting and illuminating was this little bit that you wrote about a one-episode Simpsons character named Frank Grimes. Can you tell me why that character was so important to you?
Oh, sure. Well, it's from an episode called Homer's Enemy, which is one of my favorite Simpsons episodes of all time. And it's also one of the darkest Simpsons episodes of all time. And the idea is to kind of showcase how sort of an outsider, more of a realistic figure, would kind of see Homer Simpson and his incredibly charmed life. So they introduce this character named Frank Grimes, who has, you know, sort of this modern-day Job, where just every horrible thing in the world happens to him, and he just struggles and struggles and struggles and just barely gets by. So Mr. Burns sees like a news story about him and decides to hire him, and he's just filled. So he goes to work at the Springfield power plant, and he is just filled with rage at Homer Simpson because Homer Simpson is dumb and never tries and just breezes by and yet has this incredibly charmed life. But I thought, you know, like so many Simpsons character, he sort of becomes this pop culture archetype, just this doomed man, this man who works and works and struggles and just never gets anywhere. And growing up, I felt like Frank Grimes. I felt like you cannot win. I used to joke growing up that I believed in God because somebody very powerful had to be conspiring against me.
So I think we should talk a little bit about your life chronologically. Things changed a lot for you when you were in early adolescence, but what was your family like, family life like before that?
Well, I like to say that, you know, when I was about 11 years old, my family made a tumble from the neurotic middle class to the feral working poor. So basically what happened was my father got divorced when I was about 2 years old. He worked for the government. He was a bureaucrat. He hated his job. So my parents divorced when I was 2 years old. And then my mother, she kidnapped me. She didn't get custody of me. My father got custody, even though he had multiple sclerosis. And she kind of took me on this mad last dash down to Texas and then to California. And then I guess my father sent bounty hunters to go and retrieve me from my mother. And somehow I got back to my dad, and he remarried, and then he worked for the government, and he quit. so that he could become a real estate agent. He was quite the believer in the American dream. And this concept, you know, that if you read the right books and you did the right thing, you could become fabulously, fabulously wealthy, even with no money down. And then he quit his job and he sort of tumbled into poverty. And we had like 2 years in the wilderness, basically, where my family moved down to Chicago. And things just got worse and worse and worse.
Well, hold on, because you're so far past bounty hunters, yeah. And I'm still stuck at bounty hunters. Do you remember any of this drama between your parents?
It's weird. The first memory that I have is of my biological mother, as I like to lovingly call her, of her throwing something very hard at my father, and my father ducking out of the way. So kind of my initial introduction to the world is just very, very bleak and just this kind of just vicious, you know, just hostility that just boiled over. And it was a very nasty, very, very vicious divorce. I didn't see my mother again until I was about 23 years old, and that was a very, very surreal experience. I had always assumed that both my parents were Jewish growing up because I wasn't told otherwise. And upon visiting my mother, I realized that not only was she not Jewish, but she was like a super goy. I had somehow like entered the valley of the super goys. And it just made me so much more in touch with my own Judaism. To see an instance of just how central it was sort of to who I was as a person. So it was very strange, and I, you know, I always wondered about her growing up. So I think I always had this idea that I had this very, you know, sort of strange creation story. And I was always very curious, and I was kind of like a door I didn't know whether it should be opened, but I kind of went barreling through it all the same.
Remarkably enough, your mother not being a part of your life was not necessarily your childhood central trauma.
No, it had plenty of competition.
You alluded to the fact that when you were young, just at the end of pre-adolescence, just adolescent, your father had this fall from grace. What did it look like from your perspective?
Well, for me, it was really difficult because when I was young, you know, my father was the sun. He was my hero. He was this guy that I worshipped. He was incredibly good looking and kind and sweet. And, you know, I remember every Valentine's Day, he would get me and my sister gifts, and he'd always get us goldfish. And by February 15th, the goldfish were always dead. But he was also sort of this... I wouldn't say like part-time dad, but he was always a little bit distant, you know, like he would just kind of show up and do the fun stuff. So I love the hell out of him. And I remember like his second marriage was a little rocky and just kind of wishing that my parents would get divorced. And then when they did, it was the worst thing in the world. And my father's multiple sclerosis got really, really bad. And he was just bitterly, bitterly depressed, and he couldn't find another job. And it was very much sort of this fall from grace. And I went from viewing this guy as representative of everything that was good and pure and wonderful in the world to just seeing him as this broken figure and this person who was responsible for our poverty and our... you know, the fact that we had no security whatsoever. And I was just horrible to him for 2 years. And I'm deeply, deeply ashamed. And at a certain point, he just couldn't take it anymore. And I was out of control. And I made a very half-assed suicide attempt. There's part of my book where I describe drinking down a box of caffeine pills with grape Kool-Aid. And just kind of like hoping against hope that, you know, I would like have some sort of caffeine induced heart attack. And then at like 4 a.m, I started watching Stewardess School. And I remember thinking very vividly, like, I do not want to die of choking on my own vomit while watching Stewardess School. Like, I couldn't imagine like a worst kind of experience. So about a month and a half later, my father just at wit's end had me dragged kicking and screaming into a mental hospital. And I think that was a pretty formative moment in our relationship. And that was definitely, you know, from one side to another, from just viewing my father as being this godlike figure to just seeing him as just faintly monstrous. And I think it took me a long time to kind of get over that, to see him as something other than the guy who had me drag kicking and screaming into the mental hospital. And the thing that made it worse too is that he didn't really know anything about the mental hospital. Like, I remember he was asking the psychiatrist that night, like, oh, what kind of program do you have here at the mental hospital? Like, is it Freudian in nature? Is it more Jungian? And I remember just kind of looking at him and thinking, like, you bastard. Like, this isn't like some sort of abstract intellectual problem. You know, you're not back at University of Chicago and you're contemplating, like, what is the best way to treat a troubled young man? Like, this is your son, you know, and you're going to have him, like, thrown into this place that you know nothing about. And just from an intellectual perspective, and definitely in terms of, like, how the mental hospital actually was, the whole idea that it would be Freudian or Jungian was completely ridiculous. And yeah, it was more behaviorist in orientation. So yeah, that was very, very difficult. And I feel like in a lot of ways, this book is about my relationship with my father. And he's sort of the hero of this book, oddly enough. And it's kind of about the evolution of our relationship from, you know, worshiping my dad to just despising him, to having this incredibly strong bond that means a lot more because we've gone through hell together and we've kind of come out on the other side.
It's the Sound of Young America. My guest is Nathan Rabin, the head writer for the Onion's AV Club. He's also the author of The Big Rewind, a memoir brought to you by Pop Culture. Part of the story focuses on his time in a mental hospital at the age of 14.
Well, when your father committed you, what was it like for you, and, you know, an adolescent? What did you think it was going to be like? I mean, how did it compare to your expectations?
Well, the irony is that I would sometimes fantasize about, like, what an amazing experience I would have in a mental hospital. And as a kid, I got all of my ideas from television and film. And in television and films, there are basically two kinds of mental hospitals. There's, like, you know, the very nice, idyllic people painting and doing Tai Chi and, you know, listening to classical music on, you know, immaculately tended grounds. And then there's, like, the snake pit, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest thing, where it's just a bunch of lunatics, like, lurching around in circles. And at the time that I was committed, I literally watched television for about 12 to 16 hours every day. Like, I did not want to live in the outside world. I wanted to live in, you know, the world of MTV and the world of Mr. Ed and, like, all these sort of escapist fantasies. So I remember thinking, at least if I go to, like, one of these horrible mental hospitals, like, A, I'll get, like, some really cool drugs. And B, I'll get to watch television all the time, because that's what people do in mental hospitals. They just spend all their time watching television. And, like, the first full day that I was there, I discovered that there was no television in the mental hospital. And this blew my mind. Like, this completely, like, that was outside of my frame of reference. And I think that was harder than being dragged kicking and screaming into the mental hospital. This whole idea that I'd, like, have to spend an indefinite amount of time not watching television. And I think the idea was that, you know, anything that was considered a distraction was forbidden. And I didn't write about this in the book, but it seemed very, very telling that they would wheel a television and a VCR into the hospital one day out of the month. And that one day they would show a movie. And the movie that they showed while I was there was The Wild One. And I think the message of that was, if you try and rebel and you have attitude, even if you're, like, as cool as Marlon Brando, and if you look that good in a leather jacket and tight jeans, like, if you try and rebel against the system, you will be crushed. And that was basically the overall message of the mental hospital, was you need to conform to the sort of very narrow image of mental health. And you need to be almost this grotesque caricature of, like, an obedient child. And only by doing that will you prove yourself worthy of living on the outside. And that was just incredibly, incredibly dispiriting. In my first 2 weeks there, I just rebelled. And, like, it was very empowering. And one of my first days there, one of the people, one of my fellow mental patients said to me, you know, I've been in a lot of mental hospitals. Which, again, is I think everybody should preface everything with that statement. You'll be taken a lot more seriously. If you're like, I've been in a lot of loony bins. And you are the angriest person that I've met in any of these mental hospitals. And I remember feeling really, really flattered by that. I'm like, wow. And I'm like, of course I'm angry. I'm in a mental hospital. Like, what kind of a lunatic would I be if I was like, well, this is an interesting change of pace. And almost immediately after leaving the mental hospital, which, of course, didn't happen because I got better. It happened because my dad's insurance ran out. My dad fell down, and he punctured his lung, and he wasn't able to take care of me anymore. So, like, 5 months after that, I lived with my aunt and my uncle. I ended up living in a foster family and then a group home for emotionally disturbed adolescents. So the irony was that not only was the mental hospital, a cure that was worse than the disease, but it was a cure for something that would not exist anymore. Like, I never lived with my dad after that. So I thought that was kind of painfully, painfully ironic that I just went through this month of hell for no real reason whatsoever. Although, you know, I thought, hey, maybe I'll get a book deal out of it. So I was very naive. Every trauma that I had growing up, I just start seeing dollar signs.
It also probably made it more difficult for you to come up with moderately to extremely implausible suicide attempts.
Yeah, that I did. But the thing is, I made a vow with God, who's my homie. And I said to him, if I survive this night of vomiting profusely and watching stewardess school, I also shaved half of my head for some reason, which was no crazier or less crazy than anything else I did at that point in my life. I said to God, if I survive this, I will never attempt suicide again. And I certainly won't choose a half-assed way, like swallowing caffeine pills. And I've held true to that.
It's the Sound of Young America. My guest is the head writer for the Onion's AV Club, Nathan Rabin.
Production of The Sound of Young America is underwritten in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com.
Hello, my name's Graham Clark.
And my name is Dave Shumka.
We host a podcast together called Stop Podcasting Yourself.
We are two comedians in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, but we're not jerks about it.
Yeah, we're not going to get all weird on you because of it.
Yeah, we're not trying to sell you nothing.
We're not going to try and teach you anything.
We're certainly not going to try to teach you no grammar.
Yeah, but we might teach you how to love again.
Again?
Yeah.
And again.
After your accident.
So we're very charming, and you should listen to our podcast. It's available on iTunes by searching Stop Podcasting Yourself.
Or you can find us at stoppodcastingyourself.com.
It's the Sound of Young America. My guest is the head writer for the Onion's AV Club, Nathan Rabin. His book is called The Big Rewind, a memoir brought to you by pop culture. You write about your teenage years spent in the group home, and it reminded me of something I've always wondered about. That situation. You know, I have a good college roommate who works in a group home like this and, you know, has told me about it. And one of the things that's always struck me is the fact that if you're running a home for emotionally disturbed adolescents, the nature of the emotional disturbance is completely different in every one of these young people. And so you're writing about living in a world where all your peers are emotionally disturbed, but in completely different ways, just couldn't be more different and diverse. And you're very, it seems like you learned to be tolerant in a very real way about these kids who had these bizarre behaviors.
Right. Well, I mean, we were all freaks. You know, nobody ever landed at my group home, you know, because their family was too stable or too secure. And again, it was just, I think, you know, sort of one of the tragedies of my adolescence was I just lived inside myself. And I sort of escaped into films and I escaped into television. And I didn't really make an effort to, like, engage with the people around me. And I think had I, like, things would have been easier. And when I was living at the group home, I think maybe I started to come out of that a little. Because by necessity, you're spending all your time around these people who are so, so different. And one of my first roommates when I moved in there, was could not have been more different than me. He was this guy with like this, you know, child molester pubic hair mustache, and you know, his mother looked just like him, only, you know, with a slightly less pronounced mustache. And his father had been shot in the face. He was a security guard, and he was shot in the face and killed. And he would talk sometimes about, like, getting vengeance on the people responsible for that. And he came from, like, this little hick town in Illinois, and just... It was kind of adorable, you know, and it was also, I mean, it was kind of touching because it was obviously just really, really sad deep down. We just kind of buried it. So I think it was just fascinating kind of getting to know these people who were so different. And it was almost sort of like being in the military where you don't really have any control over it. But you meet all these incredibly bizarre, incredibly interesting people. And you sort of have this bond sort of forged in the sort of shared struggle. And, yeah, I mean, I think about these guys. And I wonder sometimes, like, what they're up to these days. And in a weird sort of way, when you're writing a book like this, people become characters. And they become characters in the big rewind. And you almost have to, like, check yourself and say, these are human beings. Like, their story did not end after I saw them for the last time. They're not just, like, people in your book. But at the same time, I empathized and I identified a lot with people around me. There was kind of an interesting sort of, class divide in the group home where there were two kinds of people there. There were private placements, which meant that like your social worker placed you there. And those kids tended to be Jewish and very smart and very dark. They just have this very, pessimistic and, you know, cynical and angry take on the world. And I feel like, you know, one of the people that I live in a group home with, I believe his name is Noah in the book, like, I think he's probably as funny and as smart as anybody I've ever met. And that includes all the people that I've worked with at The Onion. But he had no outlet for it. It just sort of manifested itself in these sort of incredibly Dadaistic displays of rebellion, where he was kind of like... Marlon Brando in The Wild One, ooh, everything loops back, where, you know, that whole, if you were to ask him, you know, what are you rebelling against? He would have said, you know, what have you got? And the last memory that I have of him, although he sought me out on Facebook, appropriately enough, was he found my dad really adorable, and he had like a really adorable grandmother, and we kind of bonded over that. But at one point he said to me, you know, Nathan, I'm going to throw a gang party in your dad's apartment. And I remember thinking, like, oh, that's so adorable. Like, what an insane, like, nonsensical idea, but I'm sure you're not going to be able to do it. And then I came home one day after I'd gone away to college, and I was with my girlfriend. We'd just seen an Ani DiFranco concert. And sure enough, I returned to my dad's apartment, and there was a gang party. And he was there, and he was, like, you know, talking about, like, oh, my God, like, things are getting out of control. And, like, my dad had let them in because he's, you know, such a sweet, such a consummate mensch. And he's like, yeah, your friend showed up, and he brought some buddies, and they're all just hanging out. And I'm like, Dad, like, they're throwing a gang party in your apartment. Like, don't you find that a little bit odd? And we just sort of, like, milled about, and it ended badly. You never would imagine that being the case, but... Yeah, one of my other friends from the group home, like, ended up getting hit in the head with a bottle. And I spent part of that evening, like, washing blood off of the walls. So, again, these are all memorable life experiences that I would not have had if I hadn't lived in the group home. And, again, maybe that, you know, broadened my frame of reference and forced me to live outside my mind a little bit, even if, you know, I also kind of retreated into myself even more. And in a weird sort of way, like, I'm kind of grateful that I went through all of these things because they made me the person that I am today.
When and how did you feel like you got control over yourself and your life again?
Well, I think a lot of it, in a weird sort of way, my sister went to University of Wisconsin at Madison. And she's a year and a half older than me. So I visited her when I was when she was a freshman, and I was 15. And I remember going to Madison and just being blown away and thinking, like, oh, my God, like, this is like some sort of crazy hippie utopia. And I'm a freak and a weirdo in Chicago, but I'm, you know, going to be accepted and loved and tolerated and embraced in this, like, weird little world onto itself. And I remember seeing The Onion there and thinking, like, oh, my God, who are these people and why aren't they rich? And I just had, like, this weird idea that, you know, I had some kind of, you know, connection to it. So I think moving to Madison is kind of when my life really began and when I could sort of, get rid of some of the shame and the self-hatred, that came with, you know, having your mother abandon you, that came with, being put into a mental hospital, that came with being kicked out of a foster family, that came with living in a group home for emotionally disturbed adolescents, where I could stop being this freak and embrace all the weirdness.
Well, Nathan Raymond, thank you so much for taking this time to be on The Sound of Young America.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Nathan Raymond is the head writer of The Onion's AV Club. His new book is The Big Rewind, a memoir brought to you by pop culture. That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I've been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our editor is Nick White, our intern Mariel Reyes. Our music is provided by Dan Wally. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, where you can also find our free podcast, among other things. If you have thoughts about the show, you can always email me directly. My personal email address, yes, it's really my real email address, is Jesse, J-E-S-S-E, at MaximumFun.org. We'll see you next time, right here on The Sound of Young America.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beats. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.